Welcome to The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. Here's your host, Jeff Nadeau.
What's up, everybody, and welcome into another edition of The Sit Down, an organized crime and mafia podcast. Hope you're having a great day wherever you are. We are back better than ever. Another week, another sit down. And as I always say, we got another big one for you here on a summer week. We are getting deeper and deeper into the summer. Before we know it, we'll have the fall weather, we'll have football, we'll have Christmas. Time just flies anymore, but we got another episode this week. Going to do a Q&A. A lot of people enjoyed that last week. Might as well do it again. We got some good questions. We're going to talk about a new film in the works. That's exciting, involving the mob. And we're going to talk about Paul Castellano. Paul is a guy that I think a lot of people, when it comes to history, they know who he is. They know he was killed on 46th and 3rd in front of Sparks Steakhouse. But the question is, was Paul Castellano an effective boss? I guess we'll see. We'll figure that out today. Our great and loyal co-host, Blackjack Fletcher, joins us. Blackjack, what's happening? I feel like I haven't talked to you. How you doing?
I'm doing great, brother. Doing great. We got a lot to get into this week. We got a big show here.
Yeah, we actually have some news to talk about as well, which is exciting. And this was kind of announced over the weekend, Friday night, I think it was. But you and I have talked before on the show about Gotti, the original Gotti, the HBO film, came out in 1996. We've kind of raved about it. And, you know, I've said before, I think it's one of the best, if not the best mob film ever made. I just think it's so terrific. Armando Sante, just as you talk about, just kind of was the role, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, you look at the rest of the cast, whether it was Anthony Quinn as Neil Della Croce or William Forsythe as Sam Gravano, or You know, all the familiar faces that we see. It was just a terrific film. Most of it was indeed true, as we know. And it was announced this weekend that, according to reports, they're going to create another Gotti film. Now, I'm a little confused as, I guess, to what I think this film is going to be. According to Entertainment Weekly, it'll basically be a sequel that is involved with new directors, a writer, but the same actor. So Armand's going to be in the film, Dominic Chianese, William Forsythe, but it's going to be taken over by the writer that was on The Green Book, which is a great film that had a bit of a mob overtone to it in certain scenes. But I guess your overall thoughts, this was obviously surprising. This is not a film that I thought would ever be kind of touched at all.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like you said, Jeff, we both have spoken at length on the show about how much we love that movie. I mean, one of my favorite movies of all time in any genre. And the acting was outstanding across the board. But the question I have is, and this is what I said to you when you called me and told me about it, is how do you make a sequel to it? Like, it ended with John Gotti sitting in his cell in Marion. You know, like, I don't know. Are we just rebooting it? I mean, because even a prequel, Jeff, like, if you think about it, the movie starts out, you know, with Gotti kind of, you know, running his crew and, you know, doing his thing on the streets. Like, I mean, how much further back can we go? I mean, Armand DeSante is considerably older now, obviously. I mean, we're talking, you know, what, 20, 25 years later. So, I mean, How are you going to do a prequel with that?
Well, I think my thought on the film is going to be that it's similar in a way to Godfather 2, where they go back to John's youth, probably. And it's really almost a connection between his youth and his own son's youth. And you know, down the road they get into, I think, obviously him kind of thinking about all this in prison and, you know, I guess I'm sure there'll be something involved. The interesting thing that I read in this original entertainment piece was the second paragraph states the original cast from the Emmy award-winning crime drama, including Armando Sante, Dominic Chianese, William Forsythe, and Robert Miranda, will team with Green Book writer Nick Vallelonga. Robert Miranda played Frank DiCicco. Mm-hmm. So Frank DiCicco is involved in this film. You've got to figure there's going to be some sort of prequel to this. Now, because again, if we know anything about DiCicco, he was killed, you know, during Gotti's reign and, you know, before Gotti was arrested. So I'm really fascinated by this. I am a bit, and I kind of word this correctly. It's been talked that John A. Gotti Jr. is going to be involved in this. He's a key advisor, according to people. And I know Angel Gotti's sister kind of mentioned that on Twitter. I think the Gotti family at this point has seen a lot of books being written about their dad and about them. And I think this is about righting some wrongs a little bit, talking about facts, you know, talking about people that have written books, particularly John Alight, who, you know, we don't talk about much in the show, but John Alight wrote a book called Gotti's Rules and told a lot of not many facts as far as what really happened. And I think this is John's idea. And I think he wanted to do this with the one in 2018. It didn't end up working out, but I'm excited about this just because the fact that the reason the film was so good is because Armand Asante was in it. And you mentioned it. He's a little older. In fact, he's significantly older. I don't know if you've seen William Forsythe recently. He looks brutal. I mean,
Armand Asante doesn't look great either.
Yeah. I feel like Armand, you know, he's older. I feel like, you know, with a little touch up, I feel like he can look fine. But, you know, by the way, I wanted to ask about this. Does Dominic Keane Acey ever age? Seemed like no. He was old in The Sopranos. He was. Like 20 he was. Years
that,
ago.
Yeah, that guy looks the exact same. It's if you nuts. Go back 25 years ago to today. It probably was like, it's one of those things that, like, you know, it's not great when you look like you're, you know, 70 when you're 48. But, you know, when you're 85, it's a pretty good deal.
I mean, we have to remember Dominic Keane Acey played Johnny Ola in Godfather, which was a long time ago. I mean, and keep in mind, Dominic Keane Acey is 90 years old.
It's crazy.
But I think now, you know, people that are in their 90s, I mean, there's still a lot of spry 90-year-olds, right? But it's going to be really interesting. I do worry just a bit because one of the reasons that I thought The Irishman was cheapened was the fact that, you know, they have De Niro in it and some of these guys that are so old. And you're making them play younger roles. So I guess we'll see. But I think it's going to be a mix between a prequel and a sequel. I think it's a lot of John in prison, flashbacking in his life, kind of like Vito Corleone did in The Godfather. And then obviously what goes on after John, because John Jr. ran the mob, according to the FBI. So it's going to be interesting. I'm looking forward to it nonetheless.
Yeah, I mean, listen, absolutely. I'm looking forward to it. It's great actors. It's great writers. I feel confident they will produce something that's going to be quality. I'm just a little apprehensive until I hear more about it.
Yeah, but again, very excited. Looking forward to it. Real quick, just wanted to throw this out. I'm not going to spend much time on this. We'll get into this maybe next week. We have too much to do to kind of talk about it this week. It's really kind of a quick story, though. It's not necessarily mob-related, but I think it's interesting. And Blackjack, I don't know if you heard about this. Did you hear about White Boy Rick is suing the FBI for $100 million? Did you hear about that?
No, I didn't.
So White Boy Rick, I've talked about him occasionally. We'll get into him at some point. It looks like he's filing a lawsuit with the FBI. And good for him. The FBI used White Boy Rick pretty hard. And he went to prison for 30 years, recently got out. Looks like he's filing a lawsuit, 10-page lawsuit. Basically saying that they coerced him into working for them, allowed him to be almost killed, and then they didn't come to his aid. Again, White Boy Rick is an informant, okay? He knew what he was doing. But this is an interesting story. I'll be interested in seeing if he gets the government – because, look, did a long prison sentence, Blackjack. Did 30 years. I mean, some of the people involved in this case were murderers and did less time than 30 years. Just kind of a wild story. Detroit was wild back in the 80s, whether it was Johnny Curry or the Best Friends Gang. Just so many wild things going on in Detroit. We're definitely going to have to talk about this down the road, but just wanted to gloss by that. But all in all, a decent news week. I'm excited about the Gotti film. We don't have a date on when it'll be out, but I'd probably imagine next year sometime. They haven't even started much filming with it yet. But we'll see. Hopefully they get the right director. Directors are important, as we know. All right, let's get into the Q&A. I want to first thank everybody for listening. Just really enjoyed doing this show every week. We continue to gain so much steam, and we thank you all for checking out. And we thank you for interacting with the Q&A. Some of these questions are really good, and it's nice to get to know them. Paul Castellano coming up. Let's get to the Q&A. First one, Mike Murphy. Good comment. He left a question last week. He asked, why do families' names change? How could Luciano not have a family named after him, and do the members use the names we know? Or is it just a media thing? Well, look, first of all, that's a great point. I would have to feel like Lucky Luciano should have a family. Keep in mind, he was the innovator of the commission. He's probably, you know, on your Mount Rushmore of mobsters. And you'd probably have to wonder why he doesn't have a crime family named after him. But as far as do members use the name? Why do names change? Not really. Do I wonder why people like Joe Colombo have a family named after them? Probably. Have they ever been thought about being changed? I'm sure at some point. I mean, we talked about Joe Messina looked at to change.
He tried, yeah.
The Bonanno crime family at one point. And look, he probably should have. I mean, Joe Bonanno was a pretty big stain on the mob towards the end of his life. But why they don't change and why they do change is really your guess is as good as mine. So when you look at the Anastasia crime family that ends up being the Gambino crime family. I guess it's really just about power and what people want to do and what they want to change. I guess I don't have a legitimate answer as far as do the people in the families use these names. I mean, I think it's more media than anything. I don't think that current members go around saying I'm in the Gambino crime family when asked what they do for a living. It's more of an FBI and a media thing for sure.
Yeah, I definitely think it's more of a media thing. And as far as the names being changed, I think you hit the nail on the head. It's power and control, right? Like Joe Messina tried to do it. I think at that point in his life, he probably didn't have the sway to do that. But you look at someone like Carlo Gambino. Carlo Gambino was a guy who was very well respected. He was a very powerful man. And, you know, I think when you want to make that move at that point, especially with the way Albert Anastasio went out, you know, yeah, it's probably guys are probably going to go along with that.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting question. And I don't know if we'll ever have, you know, the answer to that, but a fascinating question nonetheless. Let's just make this clear. They're never going to change. Okay. No one's going to come along and change, you know, the Lucchese crime family or something. Yeah, it's not going to happen. But a good question nonetheless. Does the Chicago Outfit or Detroit partnership have the same formalities when it comes to being made? Do they have a ceremony or introduction similar from one made guy to another? Well, look, I'm not in the mafia. I don't know. But what I do know is I would have to, and I've never been to a making ceremony. Neither is anyone that would know unless they told it. As far as in those families, Detroit has never really had anyone cooperate. So I guess our guess is as good as whoever's. As far as though what I know, all the American Italian mafia people, as far as ceremonies are concerned, they all do the same thing. Now, I think the question is, what do they do now in general? Because from what I understand, being made now is a lot more flimsy than it used to be, right? They're making all sorts of people now. And there were points where people were paying to become made. They weren't burning saints. They weren't cutting anyone's hand or anything. So now I think it's a little different. But ultimately, I think all the families that were connected to Cosa Nostra used the same making ceremonies. Now, again, we can't quote that every single person was. But you know, there used to be a rule that you had to be fully Italian to be in the mob. Then it became your father had to be an Italian. Or it became John Stanf, I know, in Philadelphia, made a guy, John Vesey, who wasn't Italian as far as I think he was only half. So it's definitely happened. And the rules have been broken for sure.
Yeah. And I think as far as, you know, procedures and, you know, just the kind of the way things happen, everything we've talked about with Chicago seems to parallel what goes on in New York pretty closely. I mean, obviously, as you said, we don't know the intricate details, but in terms of how guys got started and how they made their way in, it feels very close to what goes on in New York.
Yeah. And again, we'll never truly know just because we've never, as far as I know, you haven't been made. Is that correct?
I couldn't tell you if I was.
Well, that's true. That's a great point. See, you know what? You're always thinking. Good point. You wouldn't tell me. But as far as I know, no. It's pretty much the same across the board. Next one. Do you think anything approaching the Boston College basketball scandal involving Jimmy Burke happens today? I know I've seen some questionable moments at the end of games. Well, look, when it comes to pro sports, it will never happen. Never.
Nope.
They make too much money. It's never going to happen. There's too much oversight. College, do I think we see anything on that scale? No. Just being real honest with you, especially with gambling being so looked at and scrutinized now. Now that gambling continues to be legalized in more and more states, what that's doing is providing much more oversight, right? Yeah. So you have the casino commissions, you have, you know, the states that are really looking into this. Do I think it'll never happen again? I'm not going to say that. You know, in college, I think the NIL stuff obviously helps as well. You know, many more kids now can make money as opposed to not making any money. Do I think it ever happens to the level of the Boston College scam involving Henry Hill and Jimmy Burke? No, not at all. Now, recently, it has happened. If you look at San Diego University, they had a point shaving scandal about 10 years ago, actually. A guy called Brandon Johnson did that. It's not – I think he was the all-time leading scorer at one point. So, yeah, it's definitely happening. I think it happened in 2013, 2012, something like that. But, you know, it happened at Toledo. It happened at Arizona State. It's happened at different universities.
Oh, yeah.
Do I think it happens now? No, I don't.
I think there's two things at that question that you touched on. The first is, and it took governments in this country decades and decades to learn this, which is that nobody has more incentive to keep games on the up and up than sports books do.
Right.
They have the ultimate incentive to make sure that games are legitimate. So legalizing gambling does nothing but make it harder to effectuate these schemes. Do I think it could happen again? You know, I always think back to another podcast I listened to, Jeff, last year, Whistleblower, about Tim Donaghy in the NBA.
Right.
And Tim Donaghy would always say, you know, the only way you're ever going to do this is with a referee. You're not going to get players.
Right.
He said, you know, a referee is the guy you can get. And yeah, to that extent, do I think we'll see these scandals pop up from time to time? Yeah, I think we will, because, you know, there are guys who are always going to be interested in making a little bit more money. But are we going to see a team out there doing it? That would stun me if we ever saw that again.
Well, I know this was 2019, late 2019, early 2020, right before the pandemic. I know the Justice Department announced I think it was 25 people, an indictment, Colombo family up in New York. And an individual that was in that indictment, what was the kid's name? Befalco, I believe. He mentioned at one point that he had an unidentified college basketball team that they were on the take, according to him. And this was through wiretaps and things of that nature. And that he was on the phone at one point and asked whether it was okay for him to talk about this on the phone. The individual he talked to responded, I mean, why not? You talk about everything else on the fucking phone. You're an idiot. Again, I guess from what he detailed is that he planned to persuade players to lose games by a huge amount and that he was actually doing this. So whether this is true, I don't think we'll ever know. He was charged with sports bribery, but you know, that's the latest I've known. And that was pretty recently. So, but do I think anything happens on the level of CCNY or BC? No, hell no. There's too much scrutiny. There's too much oversight. But yeah, things happen at the end of games. Maybe it's just that the bookmakers are very good at creating the lines. And look, do refs do things they shouldn't do? Yeah, probably. I mean, there's all sorts of refs that I wonder about.
And that's one of those things too. And I'll again reference Tim Donaghy, because I thought Donaghy had a really interesting viewpoint on his whole scandal, which was he was adamant that he never fixed a game, because in his mind, fixing a game would mean calling a foul that wasn't a foul. And what Donaghy would say is, he said, I could call multiple fouls every time down the floor. He said, we don't do it, but every whistle I blew was a legitimate foul. He said, sometimes was I calling more fouls on one team than another? Yes, I was. But they were legitimate fouls.
I got to tell you, I don't believe much of anything he says, just to be
honest. It's interesting the lines that he draws, you know? Right. Like, he's got these hard lines that you look at and you're kind of like, all right, well, why are you drawing this line here? It feels arbitrary, but interesting guy to say the least.
I do think one thing he always said was interesting about how, you know, he's not the only one doing it. I've heard him say that before. And look, he also talked about certain refs back in the 90s and 2000s that, you know, it was pretty evident they hated certain players, you know, Allen Iverson or Rasheed.
Yeah, I mean, and he would always say that, you know, the NBA, you know, would know, like back in the day, if you needed a game seven, Dick Pivetta was going to be your guy on the court that day.
Right, right. No, exactly. You know, Monty McCutcheon, you know, Pivetta, Joey Crawford. So, yeah, they were all – did they have issues? Were they being shaken down by the mob? No. No. I don't believe so. As far as I know. This is a Sopranos question. When Christopher takes over the sports book from Paulie, the guy talks about how Paulie would give some of the action to the Philadelphia crew. What does that mean? Chris lost a ton of money. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty simple. So think of a college football game. You have USC against Arizona State. The whole world comes in and bets USC. Most bookmakers, particularly at that level, will lay some of the action off to other crews. So take the brunt away from them a little bit.
Limit your exposure.
Yes, exactly. Because the goal of a sports book and any good sports book is to get even action on both sides. Yeah. So you have no exposure, as Black Chick alluded to. So Christopher, as a beginning sports book operator, took all the money on one side. And as we know, sports betting is very random. And he ended up losing, and he took a huge hit. Now, he should have took some of that money and delved it out to the Philadelphia crew. It's all going to one group at the end of the day anyway. It kind of limits that particular book's exposure and having to pay people out. So, yeah, a lot of books do it. A lot of places do it. I know, you know, and again, when I bet with illegal sports books, I know plenty of guys that were laying off bets to other places. So, yeah, that's a pretty common practice in the illegal bookmaking trade. You have anything to say about that?
I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head, right? You just want to limit your exposure. That's why sports books move lines, right? Because that's why the lines aren't static, because when they start getting too much action one way, they need to even it out the other way. So you move the line.
Yeah, the goal of a sports book is not to have on the Super Bowl, not that it would ever happen, there's so much action, but any big solid game on a Sunday, they want 50-50 action because the VIG is going to make them profit every time. It's just that simple. This isn't really a question, but can you discuss why Joey Merlino doesn't get the credit he deserves? Modern day, he has to be one of the top guys since the 90s. He took over in his 30s, survived multiple attempts to grab power, did his time, still is in control, and no rats out of his main crew. First of all, allegedly, he's still in control. We don't know whether he's in control or not. That's just according to the FBI, who don't have a flow chart. They just guess. As far as Joey Merlino, though, yeah, look, I mean, Joey's been in and around that life really since he was a kid. If you know anything, his father was connected to Nicky Scarfo. He's very connected, frankly. Joey, I think the thing about him that a lot of people don't understand and realize is in Philadelphia particularly, the crew that has been in control at one point and maybe still is, they are all very connected to each other. They've been friends since they were young boys. They've run together. They're actually friends, right? They don't have they have an iron wall up around them, basically. And no one is ever going to get into that. No one will ever cooperate out of that crew. And most of them are old men at this point. They're 50, 60 years old. They've been to prison. They understand how it goes. And as far as him being a top guy, yeah. I mean, Joey decided at one point, and this came out in the trial, that, you know, he wanted to grab power, and he did that. He was willing to go to war with certain people as far as John Stanford was concerned. And, yeah, I mean, he has been involved for a long time. But, yeah, that crew's never going to cooperate. And when you have a big family, like let's say the Gambinos or the Genoveses and all these different groups, you come in contact with so many different people. Now, some might be friends, but the truth of the matter is very few have actually been long-term great friends their entire life. in Philadelphia, it's so small. South Philly in that neighborhood is a small area. I mean, it's 10 blocks maybe. Everybody knows everybody, and everybody's friends with everybody, and they're never going to go against each other. It's that simple. I don't care how many times, how long they're facing. We saw that a couple years ago. A guy, Anthony Nicodemo, the FBI said that he, the state of Pennsylvania said he killed somebody. They were throwing 50 years at him. He could have cooperated, didn't say a word. He's going to do every, you know, he's going to do 30 years probably. These guys don't cooperate. They just don't. And Blackjack, that's just something in most families you don't have. These guys have known each other since they were babies.
Yeah. I mean, listen, when you have those ties, right, that's something that's a lot harder to break. So it's going to be a lot harder for the government to turn these guys when they've known each other as long as they have.
Exactly. This is a question I didn't really get any elaboration to. This guy just says, who is the Pittsburgh Connect? I know it's a real thing. I'm guessing he means in Goodfellas, the guy in Pittsburgh that Henry was dealing with. He was actually a real person. I don't think we mentioned him, I think, briefly. It was a guy, Paul Mazey. He was actually featured in that documentary on ESPN about that scheme at Boston College. They kind of all go hand in hand. But Henry was being provided cocaine from Paul Mazey. They met, I think they were in Allenwood or Lewisburg. And that was the guy they ended up talking about. I think he's played by Beansy Gaeta in Goodfellas, if you remember. That was that person. I think that's what he's talking about here. But yeah, pretty much an ancillary character in the mob, but did kind of create that whole BC sports betting scheme.
Mm-hmm.
What family or boss led the commission for the longest amount of time? Well, look, I mean, obviously we'd have to go in hand in hand as to who led the, I'd have to look that up. I don't have the exact answer, I think, per se. This is a question that kind of snuck up on me. I believe it was Lucky Luciano, as far as I know. It was founded by Lucky. He kind of put it into motion in the, you know, the 30s. And Lucky was in control for a pretty long period of time. Most bosses don't last very long, and there's other bosses that come in. We don't know whether certain bosses were bosses, whether they were acting bosses. I would just say Lucky Luciano was the purveyor of all this. And he was the chairman for, I think, 14 or 15 years. And I think he was the longest, as far as I know. I think Carlo Gambino had it for like 10 to 13 years, something like that. But I think Luciano had the longest. I think it was 15 years.
Yeah, I mean, that probably makes sense. I'm trying to think off the top of my head. I can't really think.
I guess Cingiganti was pretty long. But I think, what I remember, I think Luciano was started in 31. He ends up being deported in mid to late 40s. So, you know, I would say it was probably that long.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So, you know, and there were a couple that weren't long at all. I mean, Vito Genovese. I mean, he was, I think, in control for a couple of years. Joe Bonanno, Paul Castellano. I mean, a lot of these guys. So it wasn't long for sure. How many instances or documented instances are there of blood relatives killing their own family members? It's not many. It's not many at all. One of which that I do know of is a guy, Dom Cirillo. He was part of the Genovese crime family. He's a pretty high up guy there. A quiet Dom, they called him. He was the acting boss after Cingiganti went away. And in a roundabout way, he had a son, Nick Cirillo. He was involved with the mob, and according to a lot of people, he was made. From what I understand, him and his son become estranged at one point. The kid starts messing around with drugs and alcohol and things of that nature. And he's out one night, and he gets into a beef with Vinny Basciano, who was the boss of the Bonanno at the time, son. And I guess shoves him and assaults him in some way, insults him, all sorts of things. A few days later, Nicholas Cirillo disappears. And a lot of people wonder, how the hell is the boss's son disappearing? Something's going to happen here. Nothing ends up happening. And a couple of weeks later, Joseph Massino had cooperated by this point. He goes into federal prison with a wire and starts asking Basciano about, hey, did we have anything to do with the Cirillo kid missing? And he just makes the sign of a gun and says, quiet Dom took care of that, which would lead a lot of people to believe Quiet Dom Cirillo ordered the hit on his own son. Now, whether – and again, I don't think there's any conscious individual in America that agrees with that. But I will say one thing. In the mob, you are asserted things that you do. And some of these guys, like Quiet Dom Cirillo, are as Cosa Nostra as it gets.
Yep.
They will die Cosa Nostra. They will never cooperate. They're old school. And it doesn't matter if it's your son, your daughter, your mother, anybody. Cosa Nostra comes first, and you play by the rules. And Nicholas Cirillo did not play by the rules, and he was killed. And Dom Cirillo realized that no matter who they are, he broke the rule, and he had to go. And according to many people, he took care of that piece of work. As far as other ones, I know in Philadelphia, there was an instance with the Changolinis. I'm not going to really get in much to that, but that's something you can look up for yourself. I know at one point John Franzese considered killing his own son, and we all know that story. Michael Franzese has talked about that on occasion. But it doesn't happen a ton, but it has happened.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that if you think about, it's not going to be a common occurrence, right? So,
no.
And then it's probably something, too, that a lot of people just aren't going to talk a ton about because – it's going to be something of a sensitive issue, I would imagine. So you combine those two factors, and yeah, there's not going to be a ton of stories out there about that.
But yeah, I mean, there are a couple. One recently, and you can. This one's a pretty fucked up one. Sylvester Zatola, he was part of the Bonanno crime family. He was an associate. This only happened like 2 or 3 years ago. He was killed in a McDonald's drive-thru in the Bronx. According to reports, it was two black individuals and a I guess they kind of pieced it all together. His own son, Anthony Zatola, ordered Blood's gang members to kill his own father. You can look that up for yourself also. Sylvester Zatola, he was involved with video poker machines. And I remember hearing about that. That was about a year before Frank Cali was killed. He was a low-level guy, but his own son. He actually, his own son used to text message this Blood's guy, and they would speak in code, and they would talk about a film being made. And the film didn't work, and the film didn't work meant that he didn't kill him and that there were issues. So there was all sorts of things going on. I would look that up as well. Two more. After reading Michael Franzese's last book, I can't help to think he's full of it. Did he ever kill anyone or rat on anybody? No, Michael Franzese never killed anyone.
No.
Ever. Michael Franzese was made because he was John Franzese's kid. John vouched for his son as he was in prison. And Michael was a big earner. And we've talked about that. And Michael's talked about that, and that's very true. Michael made a lot of money with that gas scheme he muscled in on. He was a big earner for the family. And he had great bloodlines. And as we've seen with John Gotti and other folks, we see it with today with Paul Castellano. If you have certain family members involved, you will elevate, no matter how much of an idiot or imbecile that you are. Did Michael Franzese rat on anybody? Yes, and that's been proven. He'll never tell you that. And if I ever talked to Michael, I'd ask him directly about it. There was a music producer and I think a sports agent called Norby Walters. You can look it up. Michael cooperated against him. And that's pretty much common knowledge. In fact, Newsweek reached out to Norby Walters about it. Norby decided that he did not want to speak about it. But Michael will not mention it, but it happened. Norby was a friend of his. And he would not talk about it. So yeah, he's definitely cooperated. If you have a 302 session with the FBI and you give incriminating evidence that's used in court, you cooperated. It's pretty simple. I don't know how difficult that is.
That's it. And you hit the nail on the head. No, friends, he's never killed anyone. Yes, he ratted on people. That's about all you need to say about him.
Did he rat on other mobsters? Not per se. He has done 302s and he gave names. And to me, that is a cooperator. It's pretty simple. I think he has some weird reason as to why he's not a rat, but he is. And if I ever could speak to him, I would ask him about that. Oh, all right. One final one. Are there any female famous mob figures? In Italy? Yes, there are many. We're not going to get into them. There are so many. Are there any American mob people that are women? No. Though Carmine Galanti at one point had an auspice to believe that he was going to make his own daughter. In fact, he tried to do it. It didn't end up working out, but that one is common knowledge. As far as There was a woman, Virginia Hill, if you know anything about Bugsy Siegel, there was reason to believe she was involved a little bit. But actual criminals, the only one that I know of is a woman called Stephanie St. Clair. She was a black gangster. She was big into the numbers game in Harlem, and she was huge during and after Prohibition. If you look her up, she was kind of involved at one point with Bumpy Johnson. He was kind of her chief, a hitman, if you will. She had all sorts of protection. She was pretty big, Stephanie St. Clair. So I would look her up if you have some interest in female gangsters. Obviously, Griselda Blanco and people like that. But as far as mobsters, no, there's never been a female mobster. Now, in Italy, as I said, a little bit different story. Good questions. Really good questions.
Very good.
I enjoy doing these. We'll have to do them more. But let's get into Paul Castellano. I have to ask you, Blackjack, before we get into the biography, give me 1 to 5 words about Paul Castellano and what your overall thoughts on him are.
The first word that pops into, well, I'll give you a couple of words. Cheap and out of touch. My overall thoughts on Paul Castellano is that Paul Castellano wanted to run organized crime like a Fortune 500 company, which in some respects is probably a good thing, but I think you have to strike a balance.
Yes.
Because there's going to be a great number of people in your organization who do not fit that mold. And it's kind of like, think like any business, Jeff, right? Like, let's say you work for a big company and you get a new CEO comes in. Some people are going to start to wonder, oh, well, you know, do I fit here? Is this thing's going to change? Are they going to be different? And it's the same thing in organized crime. And Paul Castellano, I think the overarching thought I have with him is that he was out of touch with the rank and file of his organization.
I'll make the case that basically from 1940, when Paul Castellano gets into the family, really until 1980, I thought Paul Castellano did pretty much everything you should do as a mobster. Just being honest, he was an earner for sure.
Yeah.
And we'll get into it. But Paul was a boss for 8 years, basically. And for 4 years, I thought he did an okay job, but the final 4 years were terrible. Yep. And he kind of reminds me of, in a way, Joe Mussino's reign. Joe Mussino did a lot of good things while as a boss also, but the last year or two of his reign were a complete mess. And that was his legacy. But let's get into it. A fascinating guy. We're going to get into his hit as well. I'm going to tell you who the shooters were, the backup shooters, who a lot of people don't know and get this confused. We're going to set the record straight on Paul Castellano here on the sit down. Constantino Paul Castellano was born June 26th, 1915 in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn. We obviously know Bensonhurst. They've stranglehold on a lot of mobsters. A lot of people were created in Bensonhurst. It's always been a mafia enclave. He was born to Giuseppe and Concetta Castellano, who came over from Sicily a couple of years before Paul was born. Now, it's important to understand right out of the gate, Paul Castellano and Carlo Gambino were cousins. Okay. They were very close. They're very connected. And Paul, as we'll get into, Carlo was integral in Paul's life. Paul's father, Giuseppe, was a butcher. But an important thing to realize about him was he was a butcher, but he was also involved in illicit activities. He was running a game called La Rosa Wheel, which was the Italian lottery. And he was running numbers games to Italian immigrants and made a nice chunk of change on the side. He was kicking up to the Mangano crime family and doing, you know, some good things. He was making some money for his family. Paul would drop out of school in eighth grade and decide, hey, I'm going to follow my dad into the butcher business. And you know, that would obviously lend down the road to some of the businesses that Paul got in. But he also started understanding the numbers game, some of the different things that were going on in the underworld terms. And, you know, it would kind of help him down the road learning the ropes. He would leave school in 1934 at the age of 19. Paul decides with a couple of his friends to go to a party in Connecticut. While on the way, Paul gets an idea to rob a clothing store out in the middle of nowhere. And this is where Paul would first get on the map as kind of someone to keep an eye on. Paul and his accomplices get, well, actually he gets pinched, and the police ask him, hey, what the hell went on back there? Who are those people that you were with? He responds with, I don't know who they were. I met them on the side of the road. I don't know who they were. He ends up getting a year, does 3 months. He comes home. Obviously, his reputation's a bit enhanced. His reputation was obviously enhanced because his cousin was Carlo Gambino, who had become kind of a growing member in the Anastasia crime family. But it didn't take long, Blackjack, for Paul to get some respect. And for anyone that thinks Paul is just this like hobnob kind of snobby kid, that's not true. Paul grew up tough and learned the mob pretty early.
Yeah, I mean, listen, he has a background that's blue collar, as many of these guys were. You know, kind of a similar story, drops out of school early and goes into learning a racket, right? And in this instance, it's, you know, he's running numbers and he's learning butchering from his dad. But, you know, as much as, you know, the link to Carlo Gambino obviously helped. We've talked about this in the past. These organizations value guys who they know they can trust. When Castellano got pinched and he didn't turn the other guys in and he went and he did his few months and he kept his mouth shut, that's a nice feather in your cap.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, obviously his connections helped. Carlo Gambino was his own rising star in the Anastasia family. He starts getting involved and kind of takes Paul under his wing, kind of starts teaching him some things and acts as a mentor to his cousin. In 1937, Paul would marry his second cousin, Nina Mano, which is kind of a weird, weird thing to do. I always find that odd. But in Italian circles, particularly ones straight from Italy, I have heard of that. It's not out of the question. It is a bit odd, but it definitely happens.
And hey, then Giuliani did it.
That's true. I have heard that, actually. Carlo in the 40s would get promoted to captain under Albert Anastasia, and he would kind of bring in Paul as his number two and really groom him into kind of his kind of descent into the mob. Carlo would be eventually underboss of the Anastasia crime family right under Albert Anastasia, and Paul would get inducted in the 40s into the crime family. In the 1950s, Paul would establish all sorts of different businesses. He was becoming very white collar. He establishes a business called Blue Ribbon Meats. And obviously it was a butcher business that sold meat to big grocery stores and things of that nature. One thing Paul would also do is give out loans to struggling storekeepers and things of that nature. The good thing about Paul, though, was when someone didn't pay their loan or couldn't pay, Paul wouldn't beat them up. He would just say, well, give me a piece of your business. Mm-hmm. And Paul starts establishing all these businesses. And before you know it, he's raking in a ton of money. So just because you're a gangster doesn't mean you have to act like a gangster. Paul realized that he could just take their businesses and make a ton of money from that.
Yeah, I mean, listen, that's a smart tactic, right? I mean, you're talking about a guy who is in a time period in this country, you know, we're coming out of the Great Depression, heading into World War II, you know, and his thought is, all right, well, instead of breaking your kneecaps, just, you know, let me get a quarter of the business. That's going to pay dividends, man. I mean, that's long-term thinking, right? Like that's the kind of thinking that puts a lot of money in your pocket down the road.
Exactly. On October 25th, 1957, as we've talked about on this show before, Albert Anastasia is whacked at the Park Sheraton Hotel in Manhattan. This is an overthrow attempt by Carlo Gambino to take over control of the family. And obviously that would be big news for Paul. Carlo would be ascended to boss, and Paul would kind of take over the role of underboss. In 1957, basically a month after the Albert Anastasia hit, Paul is involved in the Apalachin meeting, which was this big summit of all the big chiefs of the American mob that was held in upstate New York. What happened was there was a guy, Joe Barbara, had a home in upstate, and they kind of had a meeting. It was a board of directors type of meeting, and 100 or so individuals came to this meeting, including, you know, Frank Costello and all these different people. The feds kind of busted. Paul is one of 60 people that gets arrested for the Appalachian raid. Paul refuses to answer questions, gets hit with a year for contempt. So Paul was a guy that quickly decided that he was always going to be silent. He was never going to cooperate. He was never going to talk. This kind of revered Paul as well in kind of the scheme of the Gambino crime family and in the mob in general. Paul would again also be sentenced to 5 years in prison a few years later for withholding information, but that would be overturned by an appeals court. Blackjack, Appalachian was a meeting that I think is so fascinating, and it happened many times. We've seen, obviously, it happened in Atlantic City in the 20s. I know Al Capone was involved with that and other people. There's been all sorts of these kind of board of directors meetings, and there were some interesting people at this meeting, whether it was Russell Bufalino or, Carlo Gambino or Michael Miranda or Vito Genovese or Joe Ida or whoever. This Santa Traficante was there. So many important people were at this meeting. Wouldn't you have loved to have been a fly on the wall in that meeting? And that would have been incredible.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, you know, you think about the, like you said, the personalities in the room and kind of what's being discussed back and forth is fascinating to wonder. And as much as I'd love to be a fly on the wall, you bet your ass the government wanted to be a fly on the wall.
Yeah, literally every family was represented. Cleveland, Dallas, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, Buffalo, Utica had some representation up there, Kansas City, Colorado. Everyone was represented. Everyone had a say. It was such a fascinating and kind of nondescript. Who would have thought? It's like, would anyone have known Woodstock was going on if it wasn't promoted? No, it was in the middle of nowhere, right? This was completely not promoted. But Paul was obviously jammed up in this, and he would have to take a pinch for it. Once he gets out for the contempt charge, Paul would also create another business called Dial Poultry. It would supply hundreds of butchers around New York and the East Coast with chicken. And he would literally strong arm people into taking his merchandise. If a store owner said, I don't want it, he would intimidate individuals into taking the products. And he literally had a monopoly on the chicken business in New York. It's that simple.
Hence the nickname, the Chicken Man.
Correct.
That he was given. Yeah. I mean, this dude, and this isn't just like mom and pop shops, like he was distributing to supermarkets in New York, right? I mean, like I saw him looking this up that he was distributing to Waldbaum supermarkets. That was where I had my first job.
Really?
Well, I was a high-speed scanning technician at Waldbaum's.
How about that? So you were a cashier?
A high-speed scanning technician.
Right. You ever let anything slide when your friends came in?
I mean, you know, you could play around.
Now, is Waldbaum still around?
No, Waldbaum's went out of business probably about 10, 12 years ago.
The sad state of family-owned grocery stores.
Yeah.
In America, they're a dime a dozen anymore.
That's right.
The big corporations, Acme and Wegmans, and I know around here we have Giant, which is buying up everything, and it really kind of put a monopoly on everything.
Yeah.
Paul Castellano obviously would be very much involved with labor unions and construction. One of the facets of construction he was involved in was concrete construction. His son was the owner and president of a concrete corporation called Scara Mix. And they start out really controlling Staten Island. They pretty much had a monopoly on everything that went on in the concrete world. And obviously, as we know, in the Concrete Club, it was a cohort of contractors that literally handled every contract in New York involving concrete. And Paul Castellano was in control of the Gambino family faction of the contractor group. And when I say they controlled every yard of concrete, they did. Anything that was built in New York in the 80s and the 70s was controlled by the mob. So when we talk about Donald Trump and we talk about all these different people that were building skyscrapers and hotels and all sorts of different places, the mob controlled them. Tony Salerno, Vincent Gigante, Paul Castellano, they were in control of contracts, and every yard was controlled by them. The contractors involved would get a 2% kickback of the contract value every time a contract was created, and that went to the commission. I mean, Paul was in control of different Teamster unions and all sorts of different things, whether it was the Javits Center or Trump Hotel or whatever. Concrete was literally controlled by the mob, and every individual that worked on it was controlled by them pretty much as well. It was truly wild. Look, my dad was in the concrete business for many years. I don't think people quite realize how many yards of concrete have been laid around America. You ever think about that?
I mean, parking not until you just said it, but if you think about it, it's everywhere.
It's stupid money. I mean, look at every – look at sidewalks, parking structures, just build – I mean, everything. Concrete is so important to a city, and the mob literally controlled it. It's pretty wild. In 1975, Paul would get some good news. His daughter Constance met a young man. He was pretty happy about it. However, this is where the deranged side of Paul Castellano would come. And this is where, for me, the whole argument that Paul Castellano was not a tough guy and whatever, this is where I don't necessarily believe that. Because Paul would do stuff like this. So, and I think we talked about this with the Messino show. Paul, his daughter has a boyfriend, Vito Borelli. And Borelli, in the height of some fun conversation at one point, says that Paul reminds him of Frank Perdue, who was kind of a goofy pitch man for Perdue Foods. He was the owner of the company, kind of a young looking, or not a young, an older looking, like, what would you even say, like Pee Wee Herman almost, right?
Yeah, like, I mean, kind of. I mean, you know, you hit the nail on the head. But he was just a goofy guy, right? Like, I mean, he would often have like a baby chick around him when he would do things.
Yes, that's right. Yeah,
you know, he was kind of an odd guy. You know, he was the CEO of Perdue, which, you know, was a giant company even then. But he was also, as you said, the pitch man. I mean, I can remember seeing TV commercials as a kid with Frank Perdue on them. You know, I mean, I remember those. And he was kind of a goofy guy. And, I mean, listen, there is a slight facial resemblance to Castellano. The nose is kind of similar. And, yeah, I think Castellano did not enjoy being compared to the goofy chicken man.
Yeah, according to people around Paul, he was so insulted that he orders Borelli to be killed. Okay, he doesn't even say, oh, what it might affect my daughter or something. He says, fuck this guy. He's got to go. And many years later, Joe Messina would reveal that he killed Borelli as a favor to Castellano. So, and John Gotti was supposedly involved in that hit as well. Whether that happened, we don't know. So by 1976, Paul is on top of the world. He's making tons of money in the construction business. He's the underboss of the Gambino crime family. He's rich, he's powerful, and he's successful. He's doing it, a lot of it, through white collar. He's not really putting himself out there, killing people and things of that nature. But in 1976, towards the end, in October of that year, Carlo Gambino had been sick. Carlo passes away at home of natural causes. And I think there was a big question mark in the Gambino family at this point. Who would take over? Yeah. And the two options to take over were Paul, who is Carlo's cousin, and a really tough guy, really the opposite of Paul, Anelio Neil Della Croce. And if you know John Gotti, you know about Neil. We're going to do a show on him very soon. Neil was a really scary individual. And I know a couple of FBI people have said, when it comes to kind of people that they were generally scared of, Neil Della Croce is someone that's always mentioned. He had this stare, if you will, that just kind of pierced you. He had eyes that just kind of almost looked through you in a way. And he was a scary looking guy, man. And I think everyone would agree that Neil probably deserved the promotion. He deserved to be boss. And I think a lot of people would have enjoyed having Neil as boss. I think a lot of people also enjoyed Paul as boss because, you know, Paul was making a ton of money at this point. Yeah. But on his deathbed, Carlo Gambino assigns his cousin Paul Castellano to take over and succeed him. Now, the problem Neil had was he wasn't going to do much about it because he was in prison, and Neil was Cosa Nostra. He was not going to agree with the rule, but he was also not going to fight it either. But a lot of people thought they would benefit from having Neal. He just kind of accepts it, though. But as we know, there's strongly a crack developing in the Gambino crime family because there are a lot of people that are pissed off, Blackjack, that Neal didn't get the promotion over Paul.
Yeah, I mean, listen, this creates a fissure in the Gambino family that ultimately leads to Castellano's death because, as you mentioned, Neal Della Croce was the epitome of an old school gangster, right? He was the guy that came up in the streets. He ran all these different rackets. He was the guy that the guys on the streets looked up to. And Castellano was a different guy, right? Now, you can argue back and forth who should have gotten the job, who did get the job, why he got the job. None of that really matters. It's Gambino's decision. He made it. Where I think Castellano went wrong, and I'm curious to get your take on this, is Castellano takes over and he keeps Mr. Neal as underboss, which I think he thought was the right thing to do to try to appease people. I think in hindsight, what you essentially did is you created two families.
Yes.
You created the guys on the street reporting to Neal and the guys running businesses and things like that reporting to Paul. I think, Jeff, he would have been better off maybe moving Mr. Neal to Consigliere or something.
Right.
And putting one of his guys as underboss so that there's a kind of a continuity, you know? I mean, Mr. Neal felt like – he feels like at that point in his life, you know, he's getting up there in years. His health wasn't great. Maybe the role of Consigliere is something that, you know, the guy certainly has enough wisdom for multiple lifetimes. I mean, he's seen and done it all. But maybe having the guys reporting to him on the street isn't the right thing to do.
Yeah, I think probably, I get your point. Maybe elevating Bilotti as the, you know, the underboss probably would have been the smart idea. And Neal would be the consigliere kind of dealing with the guys in the street. But yeah, you're right. It definitely set up a real crack in the family, if you will. In the late 70s, one of the mistakes Paul makes as boss is he becomes powerful, surely. He already was. He was rich. He was powerful. But he starts doing things that are very hypocritical, one of which was he bought a home in Staten Island. It was gigantic, $3.5 million, 17 rooms, had a pool, a garden. Yeah, it was called the White House. And Paul was a guy that was really ostentatious in really everything he did. And Paul had a couple of rules, one of which was no one could sell drugs in the family. He looked at it as a stain. Carlo had the same idea. But the issue that Paul would create here is he was extremely hypocritical because Paul was taking money directly from a group in South Jersey called the Cherry Hill Gambinos. The Cherry Hill Gambinos were a group, that were connected to Carlo, that were in his family, that were straight from Sicily. They set up down in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, and they were kicking up to Paul. Paul had no problem taking their money. And I think the group and the Gambinos were looking at it and saying, well, how the hell are you going to take profits but tell us we can't make money? And if you've watched Gotti, there was a scene in a kitchen where they're counting money, and they actually talk exactly about Paul taking drug money and that they're dealing with fucking nonsense that Paul's sitting up in his house making all this money. And I think Paul really alienated pretty much everyone in the family at this point. And this starts to lead to his issues. Paul was also, though, doing some really good things for the family. We talked about his alliance that he sets up in 1978 that Roy DeMeo actually sets up between him and the Westies. Now, as we know at the Westies, they were their leader, Mickey Spillane, was starting to muscle into the Javits Center and the construction stuff. And the families are getting sick and tired of Mickey Spillane. They kind of go behind his back to an up-and-coming Irish guy, Jimmy Coonan, set him up, and the Westies start doing business with the Gambinos. And they basically have the west side of Manhattan on lock. Paul was quoted as saying to the Westies, "You've got to stop acting like cowboys and acting wild. You're with us now. If anyone gets killed, you must clear it with us." So Paul was doing some really good things for the family as well, stuff like that. He was really kind of settling some scores. But Blackjack, again, he was really becoming hypocritical in some of his behavior, buying the White House, being reclusive out on Staten Island, and taking drug money, but outlawing it with everyone else.
Yeah, I mean, and let's be clear about two things here. First, the drug money thing is a big thing because Castellano was Mr. Deal and Die, right? Like, he loved to trumpet that phrase, if you deal, you die. But as you said, it was fine for him to take the money. So if I'm a guy on the street and I'm trying to bust my ass to, you know, make a living, and I'm looking at Castellano sitting up on the hill, well, why is it okay for him and not for me? Right. Yep. The other thing about this White House, and this is, Castellano thought he was being smart because, as you said, he was very reclusive. He would make everyone come to that house to meet with him. He wouldn't meet with them anywhere else. They had to come to that house. Ultimately, it wasn't the greatest decision because the FBI knows you don't leave the fucking house. So they're going to find a way in, right? They're going to find a way in. And they ultimately did. But the other thing, just logistically, Jeff, and I, for those of you who may not be familiar with the layout of New York City, Staten Island's a pain in the ass to get to, okay? It's a royal fucking pain in the ass to get to. So these guys are largely operating out of Queens, Manhattan, Brooklyn. Now you got to go out to Staten Island every time you got to deal with this guy. You're probably already pissed off as it is that you have to deal with him. Now you got to take this hike back and forth because he doesn't leave his fucking house. It just breeds resentment.
Yeah, and again, by this point, Paul is reclusive. As you said, he's making people go out and kind of summon to him out in Staten Island. And by the way, the White House is a beautiful home, if you've ever seen it.
100%.
It's out in Toad Hill. It's a beautiful, beautiful place. I feel like if you have money in New York, you know, and you don't need to go into the city that much, that's where you want to live, out on Toad Hill. But by 1979, Paul is starting to have some problems at home. Throughout this point, Paul Castellano gets diabetes, and he becomes impotent. Okay, and I don't need to tell anyone for 21 and 22 year olds out there, you don't have to worry about this. But Paul Castellano basically got to a point where he couldn't perform sexually. He wasn't getting a hard on anymore. He would go years without getting a hard on. And in 1979, Nina Mano, Paul's wife, meets a beautiful, I wouldn't say she's beautiful, a good-looking woman called Gloria Alarte. Alarte was a Colombian woman that was a maid. She starts cleaning up around the house, and they needed a maid. The house was huge. The problem was they couldn't really communicate with her. So they get her this like little mini computer, and they start transcribing phrases on it. And they would give her messages, you know, make coffee or you know, go vacuum the floor or make sure you use more sugar in the sauce this week or whatever. Paul would also start to message her. And this was really messaging before it.
Yeah.
Was cool to message people.
Paul Castellano, the forefather of sexting. Who knew?
Yes. Yeah. How about that? I bet you didn't know that. We're going to put that in the description. So Paul Castellano would leave messages like, I like you. You have pretty eyes. Like, this is really what Paul did. Like, truly a Casanova he was. And at 64 years old, he had no ability to have sex with her. But he starts an affair with his own maid. And at one point, Paul decides, I need to start pleasing this woman again. I want to start feeling good again. He goes and gets a penile implant.
Yes.
And he starts fucking out of control. Eventually, his wife finds out, and it wasn't good. The problem for Paul as well is, as we saw in The Sopranos, the FBI just went to Adriana and said, look, we got you on something. You're going to talk to us. In this case, they go to an immigrant who didn't really speak the language. She says when the cops arrive, she's worried about, you know, being deported or whatever. And she just starts talking. And eventually they befriend her. They start figuring out the layout of the house where Paul did business. And again, as you said, by this point, Paul is doing all of his business at home, right? He would make you drive up there and he would sit around a table and he was do his business. And if you've watched Gotti, remember they had the meeting in his house. It was like at a big table.
Yep.
And it would become a problem because Paul was basically giving the FBI the main way to bug him. And eventually they would do that. In 1980, Paul would again be involved with a son-in-law, or a boy. I mean, this daughter of his couldn't catch a break with him.
No, she really couldn't.
In September 1980, Paul Castellano would order the murder of a guy called Frank Amato. Amato was a, you know, just a low-level hanger-on kind of guy. He actually beat Connie Castellano, Paul's daughter, which in this case, he should have been killed because he's a piece of shit. But Roy DeMeo would kill Amato, cut his body up, and dispose it in the Atlantic Ocean. So two people that were involved with Connie Castellano were killed. So do you think she told her boyfriends or prospective husbands, hey, my last two guys, they're not here anymore?
I'm going to guess probably not. Probably not a great way to start things.
Right. Obviously, as we know, these cracks and fissures are continuing to develop in the family. A young hothead called John Gotti is continuing to move around and make his presence felt. In 1983, as we know, Paul Castellano would order the murder of Roy DeMeo. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago. Roy had become a loose end and had to go. And Paul was worried about Roy because he was involved with this big car ring, and he felt that Roy maybe couldn't stand the test of time. And we all know what happened to Roy DeMeo. In 1983 as well, another big issue happens for Paul Castellano. As we talked about, he had this rule that you couldn't sell drugs. Well, in 1983, Angie Kwiatkoek Ruggiero and Gene Gotti, John's brother, get arrested for selling heroin. And this was a big problem for the Gambinos because John realizes John's a capo. John controls the Bergen crew, and Ruggiero and Gene are under him. So if Castellano finds out about this, he's going to come calling for Ruggiero, Genie, and John. John is at fault for this, just as like Roy DeMeo is at fault for Christopher Rosenberg. That's how it goes. And a lot of this had to do with the fact that fucking Kwiatkoek Ruggiero couldn't shut the fuck up.
Oh, my God.
He starts talking on tape. The FBI bugs his house, and there are all these tapes out there. And this really sets up an issue with Gotti. And down the road, he would have to demote Ruggiero, which we'll get to at one point. But this was a big problem for the Gotti crew. And this would kind of set in motion, I'm going to get to you before you get to me, in a way. But as we know with John had uber respect for Neil Delacroce. He was never going to kill Paul with Neil around. And he just had to weigh things out, as we know.
Yeah, I mean, John had far too much respect for Neil Delacroce. And Neil Delacroce, if there was one thing that he was a stickler for, it was the rules, right? I mean, Neil Delacroce knew that the rules of Cosa Nostra is what kept them together all these years. And John Gotti was not going to go off half-cocked and whack a boss with Neil Delacroce still around.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. But we'll kind of get to the untimely end for Castellano here soon. Quickly, though, in 1983, in a fit of anger, Gloria Olarte, Paul's mistress, was in a fit of rage one day. She threw all of her clothes into plastic bags and left her hotel in New York. That night, Paul Castellano would go to a hotel and beg her to return. She made on demand and went back to the home. At that point, Paul Castellano's wife understood, kind of felt bad for her in a way. She leaves the mansion and her husband in 1983. So Paul was smitten. He was done with his wife. They start going on vacations, and he buys her cars, and he loved Gloria Olarte, the woman that barely mm-hmm. could speak to him.
I mean, listen, it's an interesting relationship to be sure. We've heard about a lot of guys who have mistresses, but, you know, this relationship is really, like I said, I never would have thought Paul Castellano to be the forefather of 21st century dating, but, you know, here he is sending sexts and, you know, falling in love with his immigrant maid.
I say this about Olarte. Okay. We've on this show, and even people like Kirk Menahan have commented on our describing the wives of gangsters. Okay. So when it comes to gangsters' wives, right, some of the hottest were Josephine Masino. She was very attractive. Linda Scarpa was very hot. Mm-hmm. You know, I think Victoria DiGiorgio had a certain hotness to her in a way. Gloria Olarte, not that attractive. However, when you see Nina Mano, I think you start to kind of realize, okay. And look, there aren't very many pictures of Miss Mano, but
listen, also, let's be honest, Jeff, it's just one of those things. It's like, you know, it's just access and availability, right? I mean, Arnold Schwarzenegger had an affair with his maid. She was not an attractive woman.
Look at Monica Lewinsky.
Arnold Schwarzenegger could have had far more attractive women if he wanted to, but she's in the house every day.
Yes, good point. And she was easy. She was easy to manipulate for Paul. And, you know, I guess she had a certain flair to her, probably. In 1984, Paul Castellano would be indicted on racketeering in that DeMeo crew case that we've talked about. It would include the murder of James Eppolito and Roy DeMeo. He would also be indicted on extortion, narcotics, theft, prostitution, and other gangster-related crimes. He would be released on $2 million bail. As we know, though, in 1985, the commission case comes down. Tony Corallo, Tony Salerno, Rusty Ristelli, Carla Gambi, or not Carla Gambi, Paul Castellano, everyone gets arrested. All the bosses go away. Paul would, though, again be released on $3 million bail. So Paul was facing, at this point in 1985, Paul Castellano had to come to the realization that he was going to die in prison. It's that simple. And I think he had probably accepted that. He had no way out here. He was not going to beat these charges, Blackjack. You know it and I know it. And as we know with the commission case, Persico got 130 years. He wasn't even the boss. Or he was the boss. Or he was the boss. I mean, Salerno got 100 years. He wasn't even the boss. I mean, so, you know, Persico was the boss. He got 130. Salerno got 100 years. Castellano was going to get a lot of years here. He knew he was screwed.
He was. I think the, you know, because I've often thought, you know, Jeff, at times, you know, why didn't Gotti just wait this trial out? Because, I mean, Castellano was going away. But the problem is, then what? What happens then? Does some clown like Tommy Bellotti take over? Like, I mean, that's not going
to
fly.
He was going to have to kill someone anyway.
I mean, somebody was going to have to go, right? Someone was going to have to go. And I guess Gotti just figured, fuck it, better to get it out of the way and over with.
You have to also ask yourself, right? If let's say back in, you know, when Carlo dies, let's say Paul wasn't elevated, and let's say Neil was, it still would have gotten to John Gotti. Now, it wouldn't have went the way it did, but John would have eventually taken over the family, regardless of whether it was Paul or Neil, right? So ultimately, though, I'd have to ask you, you would agree with that, right?
It just wouldn't have been bloody. Ultimately, it gets to Gotti. I just think that it changes the trajectory of things because I think this hit, the Castellano hit that we're about to get to, was such an old school mafia hit. It was so brazen. It was so public. It was all over. I mean, it was international news. This was a huge fucking deal. And for a guy like Gotti, who had an ego to begin with, John Gotti had to feel untouchable after this hit.
And
so I don't know if Neil gets the job and maybe he promotes Gotti and then Gotti takes over 10 years later through a natural succession. I don't know if Gotti is the same Gotti that we get in 1985.
Right. I mean, he was on top of the road. He was the king of volcanoes, they say. And it's interesting, in the Gotti film, remember Gravano makes the case, shit, John, this is bigger than killing the fucking president. And, you know, that's true. I mean, Paul Castellano was a namesake. People knew who he was. And to do this the way they did it, it was pretty.
And the comparison to killing the president is totally accurate because, again, you know, like, my parents are both from New York City. My father right now, if I called him up, could tell you where he was when he found out Paul Castellano was killed.
It was like when JFK was
killed. Exactly. It's exactly the same thing. He could tell you where he was when he heard Paul Castellano was killed.
Yeah, it's so true. But before this would happen, though, Neil de la Croce, he'd have to wait that out. And Neil would die of cancer on December 2nd, 1985. And 2 weeks later, the whole thing would be set into motion. This all kind of centered around, obviously, Paul didn't leave his house much, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there was a conduit between Paul and the Gotti crew. And it was a guy called Jimmy Fiala. James Fiala was a show we'll do down the road. You talk about earners that no one talks about. Jimmy Fiala was literally a guy that ran the garbage hauling industry in New York City during the 80s. He was a huge earner. Him and Ali Malangano, huge earner. And he had a lot of interest with Paul. He was a guy that would go out and see Paul. And right around Christmas, December 16th, 1985, Fiala sets up a meeting with Castellano at Sparks. Paul liked to go to Sparks. A lot of gangsters like to go to Sparks Steakhouse. And Gravano and Gotti considered killing him at a diner at one point, but then they decided, no, let's try to set all this in motion. We'll get him to meet Fiala. He won't really even think about it. I guess we have to realize, though, if you're Gotti and Gravano, Sparks Steakhouse is at 210 East 46th Street, okay? And when we say Midtown, like, it's literally right down the street from Times Square. Like, it's in the middle of 46th Street between 2nd and 3rd. Grand Central Station is not far. It's literally right by the Diamond District. There's people everywhere.
It's the heart of Manhattan.
Yeah, it's literally wildly
Christmas
brazen.
Time, nonetheless.
Yeah, during like rush hour, 5 o'clock.
This is for those of you who maybe have not commuted in and out of Manhattan. This is the busiest time of the year in New York City. It's not the summertime; it's Christmas time. People come to New York at Christmas. They want to see the tree. They want to go to Rockefeller Center. They want to do all that crap. Go to Radio City, New York City at 5:35 on a weekday. In December is flooded with people.
Yeah, it's crazy. And what the idea was, there were going to be 8 individuals involved with the actual hit. 4 people were going to be backup shooters positioned down the street. And there were going to be 4 individuals right outside of the restaurant that looked like doormen or whatever. They would have Russian Cossack hats on. That was whatever, why they did that, I don't know. But so they would just kind of blend in. Like, no one was really going to notice.
Everyone blends in New York City. Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, the Cossack hats, they don't stand out. It is what it is.
And I feel like when you're in New York, like, you just kind of – you don't really think about that. You just kind of let your guard down, right? So Castellano and Bilotti drive up right to the front of the building. At that point, there were 2 shooters that would kill Castellano, 2 shooters that would kill Bilotti. The 2 shooters that were instructed to kill – Castellano on the passenger side were John Carniglia, who was a big-time hitman for Gotti's crew, and a guy, Vincent Artuso. They were the 2 Castellano shooters. The 2 Bilotti shooters, who was the driver at the time, they would come in really from kind of the front of the car, almost looping around. They were Eddie Leno, right? And we know Eddie Leno because he was killed years later by the mafia cops.
Yep.
And a guy called Salvatore Fat Sal Scala. He was a member of the Bergen crew as well. So they were kind of entrusted with killing Castellano. Now, interestingly enough, when the hit goes down, Carniglia proceeds to shoot Castellano. Artuso's gun jams. He ends up not firing a shot off. And Carniglia has to kill a very large individual with his gun. A lot of people don't understand that. And that was just fate. That happens. Your gun jams occasionally. Now, the backup shooters. Now, a lot of people have brought up all sorts of names for this. These were the backup shooters and a little bit about them. One of them was Angie Ruggiero. He was down the street, really close to 3rd Avenue. The other shooters or backup shooters were Joe Watts, who we've talked about. Joe Watts was a loyalist to Castellano, but what happened was Gotti goes to Joe Watts, who ends up becoming a very trusted hitman for John Gotti down the road. He goes to Joe Watts, who was a Welsh gangster. He was not Italian. He was only half. He goes to Watts and says, listen, I know you're one of Castellano's people. You've been around forever. How about we give you Bilotti's black book, loan book? Okay. Are you going to play ball? Joe Watts says, yeah, you know what? I'm an instant millionaire. Of course I'm going to play ball. So he's assigned one of the backup shooter roles. The other 2 backup shooters, one of which was a guy, Tony Roach Rampino. They called him Tony Roach because if you ever look him up, he truly looked like a cockroach. He's a weird looking character. But he was a very successful hitman. And years later, he would be murdered by the Gotti crew because he was a drug addict, a heroin addict, and ended up becoming a junkie. But actually, I'm getting him confused somewhere. He was not killed by the guy. I'm getting him confused with Willie Boy Johnson. This guy, Rampino, was actually arrested and did all sorts of time in jail. He ended up becoming an informant though, at one point. One of the other shooters was Dominic Skinny Dom Pizzonia. Really interesting guy we'll do a show on. Blackjack, this guy Skinny Dom couldn't read, had to hire people to read his court documents. He was illiterate, but there were things that he did well, two things. He cooked the hell out of a meal, and he would serve all the meals at the Bergen Crew Club, and he could kill people. And he would kill actually a couple people down the road, which we'll get to in a show at some point. But those are the four backups, Pizzonia, Ruggiero, Tony Rampino, and Joe Watts. Now, they end up not being involved in actually shooting anyone, but they would deal with crash cars and all that kind of thing. So that was that. Paul Castellano would be killed in front of Spark Steakhouse on December 16th, 1985, in a hail of bullets at 5:26 p.m. Interestingly enough, after the fact, this was gigantic and huge news. You always have to wonder, where the hell were the New York cops? Which was said in the movie.
It's a great question, but I mean, 1985, you know, New York City was a different place, brother. There was, you know, there was more crime going on there than there is today. And the reality is, I don't think that cops felt the need to patrol that part of town. I mean, that wasn't, you didn't have a lot of crime over there. You know, that wasn't one of the areas that needed a ton of police presence, particularly at 5:35 in the afternoon, you know, on a weekday. Like that just, you didn't have a ton of crime over there.
One thing that I want to do down the road is do a show, and I think it would be a good video thing to do, but I want to find people that were on the street that day, if they're still around. Not gangsters, no one involved with this.
Just people.
But just like passerbys, because there were people. Of course, you know, there were. And I'm sure there were witnesses. I'd always be interested, now that all these people are dead, you'd have to wonder. I also always wondered, like, what did Jimmy Fiala do inside Sparks as this was going on? Does he just sit there and eat his appetizers and sip his drinks? Like, how's that go?
Nobody, hope nobody comes through the door with a gun.
Yeah, and also, but like, he was involved. Like, at what point do like they, does he just leave eventually? Like, I guess they're not showing up. I'm going to get on out of here. Like, how does that work? I always wondered that, but yeah. I guess that's something I'd have to look into. But Paul would be buried in Staten Island. The Archdiocese in New York would refuse to grant Castellano a Catholic funeral, which always makes me sick, frankly.
I know.
That the Catholic Church doesn't grant people funerals because they're mobsters, even though the Catholic Church has done some of the behavior that they've done. It always interesting to me. But yeah. 2 weeks after the murder, capos would meet in a Manhattan basement and would elect John Gotti as the new successor of the Gambino crime family. He was at 45 at this point. As we know, years later, many people were enraged by the incident, including Vincent Gigante, Anthony Casso, and Frank DiCicco would indeed die because of this years later. Yeah. But that's the story on Paul Castellano. As I said, I think a pretty damn good member of the mob, really, for 40-ish years. The last 4 years of Paul's life were very hypocritical, were very ostentatious, and I think really developed a huge crack in the family that couldn't be repaired. I think Carlo electing Paul, as you said, great point, did set up a real problem because it kind of set up two families. And that was so eloquently said by you. I think Paul was a pretty interesting guy. I'm not one to say that I don't think Paul was a good leader. I think he was. As I said, I think he got a little greedy towards the end. And some of the things that he did were just kind of out of character. I think a lot of it had to do with his sexual obsessions and things. I think that was really kind of just, you know, as far as it was embarrassing, people started finding out about the penis and Laura. It was just bad for him. I don't think people ever really respected him. Did he try to be a gangster? Yeah. A lot of it though had to do with him just being a white collar guy. And not to say that like Tony Salerno and Gigante and all these guys were white collar. They made a ton of money through unions and construction, but they would kill you too. And, you know, Paul had his moments as a hardened guy. But, you know, when you look at Paul, he was very similar to Angelo Bruno in Philadelphia. You know, Angelo was a good boss. He was a smart boss. He stayed out of the limelight. But ultimately, the thing that did Angelo Bruno in was the same that did Paul in. Greedy. He wasn't willing to get with the times and allow his people to truly be gangsters and sell drugs, but he wanted to take the profits from them.
And that's, you hit the nail on the head. Paul Castellano was not, as far as mafiosos go, he wasn't a bad one. He was effective. He was smart. But greed. Greed is what did him in, and that's his legacy. That's going to be his legacy, is that greed ultimately is what did him in.
Yeah. So I guess I'll ask, as a boss, Blackjack, give me your honest grade of Paul Castellano.
B minus.
So too decent, better than average.
B minus. He was fine. I think if Paul would have just taken a few different steps, I think he would have had a much more successful and prosperous reign.
Now, that's a great question. Rating. We have to do that at some point.
It is.
Rating every, like, all the bosses, like, from A to F. So, like, F would be, like, Nicholas or Nicodemo, Little Nicky Scarfo, and A would be, like, Tony Accardo. That'd be a good game, actually.
It would be.
We'll have to do that at some point. But there you go. Paul Castellano. Right. Great show. Good stuff. Blackjack is always a bit of a longer show today, but a really info-filled show. As always, make sure you give us a follow on Twitter at the sitdown7. Make sure you subscribe if you're new around here. If you haven't, make sure you rate the show. Leave us a review. Let us know what you like, what you'd like to see with the show. And make sure you contact us and get in touch with us. Let us know what you want to see done. Blackjack, the next couple of months are going to be interesting here on the show. Got a lot to, sure, I think, weed out here and figure out. Yep. Any good show always elevates and gets better. So hopefully we can keep improving and keep doing things to take this to the next level. But we thank all of you for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode of The Sit Down. Blackjack, thanks as always. Good to hear from you. We'll see you next week. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And we'll see you next time here on The Sit Down.